With a lot of stay-at-home or quarantine orders being lifted for some states, you may be feeling even more anxiety. I know that I am. But remember, I care about you, and here are my warnings and resources again. If you are experiencing suicidal thoughts, please call the National Suicide Hotline at 1-800-273-8255. If you are suffering from domestic violence and do not feel safe in quarantine, please call 1-800-799-SAFE or 7233, or just dial 911 and leave the phone open if that's all you can do. Remember, you're not alone. There are resources. Please reach out if you need help. I'll have international resources as well as these U.S. numbers in today's show notes. Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. Charles Dickens wrote, "I confess I have yet to learn that a lesson of the purest good may not be drawn from the vilest evil." He wrote this in the preface in the third edition of his novel, Oliver Twist, in response to criticism he received by placing Oliver among so many unsavory, abusive, and evil characters. Contemporary critics accused him of exaggerating the conditions of orphans at that time, which, in 1838, was in response to the controversial English New Poor Law, a law that, instead of providing financial relief, placed poor people and orphans in workhouses. Put plainly, the rich did not want the conditions of the poor, and especially children, to be so exposed. Sadly, Dickens' depiction of Oliver Twist's life was realistic and remained so for more than a century. While attempts were made to change child welfare laws in this country, the Civil War, World War I, and the flu pandemic of 1918 left the most vulnerable of our society, orphans, to lives of indentured servitude. In the late 1920s, a woman named Georgia Tan revolutionized and normalized adoption in the United States. She operated with an impeccable reputation for almost two decades, running the Tennessee Children's Home Society in Memphis. Though there were whispers about Tan's practices, she was not really investigated until the year she died. Georgia Tan had stolen babies from hospitals, kidnapped children from the street, and manipulated politicians, judges, and police officers to help her create a legal black market for children. And these stolen children were then sold to rich people out of state, so their birth parents could never find them. Many children who were not placed immediately suffered physical and sexual abuse at the hands of Georgia and her staff. Welcome to episode 95, Georgia Tan, pedophile, kidnapper, and inventor of modern adoption. I discussed a lot of Memphis history in episode 5, the Thanksgiving Day murder of Ashley Scott. So today, I'll give you bits of Memphis more pertinent to Georgia Tan and her time there. Memphis, Tennessee, founded in 1819, was named for the ancient capital of Egypt on the Nile River due to its flood-free location high above the Mississippi River. Unfortunately, even by the late 1800s, Memphis's sanitation system was as ancient as the city it was named for. Some 6,000 outhouses or privies dumped directly into the Bayou Gayoso, a stream that ran through the business section of the city before draining into the Mississippi River. Nearly all of the Gayoso Bayou has now been hidden underground, encased in concrete. But in the 1800s, filled with human and animal excrement, spilling onto the unpaved roads and wooden sidewalks, it left pools of water that were a breeding ground for mosquitoes and other rodents. In 1900, scientists finally discovered that yellow fever was carried by mosquitoes, and a vaccine was developed in 1937 by Max Thielier, who went on to win the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine in 1951. But by the time Georgia Tan set up shop in Memphis, the city had been ravaged by epidemics of yellow fever at least six times. In the last epidemic, in 1878, some 20,000 residents fled to safer cities and never returned, and approximately 5,000 died. This panic left the most vulnerable citizens of Memphis behind, the poverty-stricken, working class, and African Americans. The only people left to care for the sick were churches and some doctors who were willing to stay. It caused the city $15 million in losses and bankrupted Memphis, resulting in the state legislature revoking its charter. That would be about $384 million today. The yellow fever epidemic and resulting panic drastically changed the demographics of the citizens. The upper and middle classes, which had ruled the political and administrative leadership, were gone. And by 1890, Tennessee had enacted a requirement of poll taxes, which disenfranchised the Black people of Memphis. The city was rechartered in 1893 with home rule, but by then, the population was very vulnerable to the schemes of dirty politicians and the new elite and greedy business class. A man named E.H. Crump, nicknamed Boss Crump, came to power in the early 1900s, serving as a delegate in the Tennessee Democratic State Convention before he was on the Board of Public Works for Memphis, then Commissioner of Fire and Police in 1907, before becoming mayor in 1910. He would serve two terms. Crump actually used Black citizens of Memphis by getting his party to pay for their poll taxes so they would vote for him. Boss Crump instituted a small commission to manage the city, which he controlled at all times. He used patronage of rich friends, ballot manipulation, and every bureaucratic obstacle at his disposal for anyone who opposed him. Criminals and gangsters roamed fairly freely, and the homicide rate soared. Crump kept a political stranglehold on the city for over 50 years. In some ways, he did a lot of good. He worked with progressives to rebuild the city, including a public school system. In later years, he was a huge supporter of FDR and the New Deal, bringing a lot of relief programs to Memphis. And of course, Memphis was one of the largest southern cities where Black people could vote. But he did a lot of it to fill his own pockets and made some pretty unsavory friends and backroom deals. One Miss Georgia Tan benefited greatly from her friendship with Crump. He protected her and influenced others to help her in her schemes. Many people believe the legacy of good he actually did in Memphis is tarnished by his association with Georgia Tan. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. Adoption has been around since ancient Rome. It basically began because wealthy men might have no heirs and did not want their riches reverted back to the state. It went on for centuries in some fashion. Usually, orphanages were run by religious charitable organizations. As I mentioned in the opening, the new poor law in England created workhouses for children and adults alike. The exploitation of children and the poor became normalized. With churches and other organizations becoming overwhelmed with needy children, and as people began to immigrate, indentured servitude began. In the United States, the orphan train movement began in 1854 and lasted until 1829. They relocated some 200,000 homeless, abandoned, or orphaned children from the crowded eastern cities to the Midwest and mainly rural areas. While some point out that many of these children wound up with families that loved them, a great many were used as slave labor on farms. Many were abused, and even those that ended up with good families faced the stigma of being an orphan train child and were ostracized by classmates and other townspeople. But as the western portion of the country became more settled, there was less demand for adoptees, and Midwestern cities began to see the neglection and poverty these children were suffering from with overcrowding, much like what had happened in New York, Philadelphia, and Boston. Several states passed laws forbidding out-of-state adoptions, or at least came to negotiations with other states. And with the popularization of organized foster care, orphan trains effectively ended in the 1920s, right about the time Georgia Tan became involved with social work. She was born on July 18, 1891 in Philadelphia, Mississippi, to parents Beulah and George Tan. Her actual given name was Beulah George Tan. She started going by Georgia in later years. Beulah Tan was a social contributor to the community while George was a chancellor. For 27 years, George had been the chancellor of the 2nd District of Mississippi. According to the Tennessee State Library and Archives, George took a strong interest in the well-being of orphans, and this is what reportedly led Georgia into social work. The Newton Record described the Tan family as, quote, prominent in judicial, church, civic, and social affairs. In 1913, Georgia graduated from Martha Washington College. In 1914, she went on to teach music at Hickory High School in Mississippi. From 1915 to 1918, Georgia continued to teach in various areas. She never seemed to stay long at any job. And from what people know of her in later years, I can imagine her haughty attitude impeding some of her employment. Author Barbara Raymond met with outrageous trouble in researching Georgia's early life for her book on Tan called The Baby Thief. Georgia's former friends and neighbors were either highly protective of her or embarrassed by her, and Ms. Raymond was met on one front porch with a shotgun when she knocked on the door. But she was able to talk to some people and discovered that Georgia's father was not well-liked, though he was grudgingly respected. He was considered arrogant, combative, and domineering. He also had the reputation of a womanizer. She found that he was an emotionally cold person who, quote, evinced little affection for children, but became known for finding homes for orphans. Georgia Tan's personality seemed to come from her father. She, too, was found to be a cold and arrogant woman from the beginnings of her business in adoption. And in her early life, she was said to be a daddy's girl, though his affection was rather conflicting. I think it's possible he would have preferred a son and more or less raised her like one. The family had an adopted son named Roy, who eventually took the Tan name, and his birth date has been different in different sources, almost like they wanted to make it seem like he was George's older brother. But then, wouldn't he have been named George instead of his baby sister? This family was really strange. Georgia even looked like her father, and she was very smart and a born leader. But her main issue in early life was probably her sexual orientation. In June 1918, Georgia went home to see her parents, and she brought a woman named Ann Atwood with her. Homosexuality was not discussed in proper Southern households, and the word lesbian was never used. And Georgia was kind of big-boned, but she also didn't conform to how ladies dressed. She often wore flannel shirts and pants, with her hair pulled back in a tight bun, and she showed no interest in marriage. Her relationship with Anne would last until Georgia's death. Anne was 8 years younger than Georgia and lived another 45 years after her. Georgia had met Anne in one of her earlier teaching jobs. The women carried on their lifelong relationship in public, often calling each other sister, as many lesbians did at the time. Considered spinsters, gay women would live together and act as though they were just best friends or relatives. Georgia and Anne did this, but they were also somewhat conspicuous. Anne became pregnant in 1924, so it's fair to assume she might have been bisexual. This didn't seem to bother Georgia, who had adopted a daughter she named June as an infant in 1922. Basically, as a family, they moved to Memphis in 1924. By then, Georgia had worked as a social worker in Jackson, Mississippi, and in a children's home society in Meridian. She was asked to leave the Mississippi Children's Home Society due to improperly placing children. She formally resigned and moved to Texas, working in the Texas Children's Society in Fort Worth for almost a year, leaving in 1921. In 1922, Georgia moved again and worked in a juvenile court in New Orleans. It was by 1923 that she began living full-time with Anne, her daughter, June, and Jack, Anne's son. By August of 1924, Georgia was working for the Memphis branch of the Tennessee Children's Home Society. And after all that hopping around, this is where she would stay. Except for the Mississippi home, it is not clear why she moved around so much, but I'm sure you can guess. The Tennessee Children's Home Society started in 1897 as a private, nonprofit corporation. It was the oldest adoption agency in Tennessee. The main office was in Nashville until 1913, when the Secretary of State let the society branch out into Memphis, Knoxville, Chattanooga, and Jackson. By March of 1925, Georgia was the director of the aid division of the society. In December 1925, Georgia, Ann, and their children spent the holidays with Georgia's parents. By this time, Ann was now referred to as Mrs. Jack Hollingsworth. It is rumored that the man who fathered her son had the last name of Hollingsworth, and that she legally changed it to make it appear that she had been married, but she really hadn't. In later years, she would drop the G and be known as Ann Hollingsworth. Many years later, when Ann was in her 40s, Georgia legally adopted her to make sure that she would be her heir. The papers basically said she had raised Ann and had been financially responsible for her for most of her life and wanted Ann to be her heir. By February of 1926, Georgia was the supervisor of the entire Memphis home. It's important to note that Ann never officially worked in the home or for Georgia. She was a secretary for the local Boy Scouts charter. But unofficially, she wrote Georgia's correspondence and later helped Georgia ferry children around the country to be adopted. Georgia quickly saw the need and the money-making prospects of selling children on the black market, which actually wasn't technically illegal then. I'm going to pause now for a word from one of today's sponsors. Technology has improved just about everything. Phones, cars, and even how we shop. Yet mattresses have more or less been the same since the invention of sleep. And we deserve better. Finally, the mattress has evolved thanks to Purple. The secret to Purple is the awesome Purple Grid. It's a patented comfort technology that instantly adapts to your body's shape and sleep style. Purple is for everybody, no matter how you sleep. And it's designed with over 2,800 open-air channels and naturally temperature-neutral gel. You'll never sleep too hot or too cold again. The Purple mattress is soft where you want it, but firm where you need it. And it's comfortably cool all over. This mattress truly does it all. I tend to be a side sleeper, which isn't always great for my back. But with Purple's design that adapts to my body, it curves with my spine instead of pushing against it, like traditional mattresses. And you can count on resting easy every night, year after year, because the ultra-durable Purple Grid won't sink or lose shape. Purple is so confident in what they do that every Purple mattress comes with free shipping and returns and a risk-free 100-night trial. Experience the next evolution of sleep. Go to purple.com/southernfried and use promo code southernfried. For a limited time, you'll get $150 off any Purple mattress order of $1,500 or more. That's purple.com/southernfried. Promo code southernfried for $150 off any mattress order of $1,500 or more. Terms apply. According to a Hastings Women's Law Journal article written by Hannah Noel Walensky, before Georgia Tan came into the picture, adoptions were considered undesirable. But when she took over the Tennessee Children's Home Society in Memphis, Georgia was able to change people's minds. Noel Walensky put it best when she said, quote, "While building her black market business, Tan helped shape modern American adoption." One of the ways Georgia did this was to effectively sell children as so-called blank slates, even older children. She would say that they would not remember their birth families and would basically fit naturally in with adoptive families after very little time. We know this is patently untrue. Even children adopted as infants fill a great hole in their lives, no matter how loving their adoptive family is. And children old enough to remember their families were certainly not blank slates. But Georgia was a canny saleswoman, and convinced many people of her blank slate theory. Noel Walensky stated that between 1850 and 1915, the annual birth rate for white Americans dropped by almost 40%. Because of this, Georgia was able to adopt out other ethnicities by, quote, selling the idea that each child was precious, even those born to unworthy parents. This was also seen as rather revolutionary and had rarely been done in the past, with the exception of supposed adoptive parents who really wanted a child slave to farm their land or serve their household. According to Linda Austin of the Tennessee Historical Society, adopting a child from the black market was not illegal at the time, but it did have, quote, distressing moral and ethical complications. That's one way to politely put it. Not only was Georgia trafficking kids, she was also placing kids in adoptive homes way too quickly. Linda Austin lists three major risks that come with placing a child too soon back then. Number one, most unwed mothers were between 19 and 24 years old, and they were, quote, susceptible to coercion from the doctors and attorneys who linked unwed mothers and adopting parents. The mothers were talked into giving up their baby in exchange for medical care. Any remaining money would go to the person who set up the adoption transaction, often an attorney. Number two, there isn't any time to see if the child and the parents are a good fit, or any real investigation into the adoptive parents' background. Number three, a child's medical history and heritage are lost. There was no way for adoptive parents to know if the child was sick or handicapped, or possibly had the genes for many diseases. Austin says that many parents went through the black market to adopt children because it was faster. A non-black market adoption could take 6 months to a year. Georgia did not conduct background checks on adoptive parents. She conducted superficial investigations of homes and parents to speed up the process. In reality, especially in later years, she didn't even really do the home inspections. In 1924, when Georgia was working at the Memphis branch, in-state adoptions were $7, $100 today. And out-of-state adoptions were $750, over $11,000 today. All of that money had to be given to the agency, but it is estimated that Georgia kept 90 to 95% of the profits and often had adoptive parents make out checks in her name, not the home's. Tennessee also gave the Memphis branch of the Tennessee Children's Home Society $18,600 a year in grant money, around $275,000 today, to help run the home. So Georgia's practice of pocketing most of the adoption money went unnoticed for a long time. She had state funding for her home. Georgia really became well known when she did something considered controversial by some and genius by others. It was a huge success. She placed ads in newspapers about children who were up for adoption. She would include photos of them. There were captions such as, "Are you in the market for a 14-month-old boy?" or "Want a real-life Christmas present?" Between 1929 and the early 1940s, Georgia ran around 400 ads. The days these ads would run, her phone would ring off the hook, especially the Christmas ads. She always chose the most beautiful children and dressed them finely for the photographs. When you think of heartsick and fertile couples seeing those ads, you can see the draw: bringing home a baby for Christmas. But her detractors said it was as if she was selling puppies. And also, Georgia was a believer in eugenics, just like the Nazis. She preferred blonde-haired and blue-eyed children. They were the easiest to place. And these children were usually the ones photographed for the newspaper ads. Georgia would go door-to-door and tell people that adopting children did more than benefit the child. It helped taxpayers as well, because they wouldn't have their tax dollars going towards orphanages or to unfit parents. She told people that in the 1930s, she was able to save Memphis residents $218,000 by placing 2,000 children. That's quite a brag. It would be over $4 million today. Georgia also traveled around giving speeches. She met with Eleanor Roosevelt, to discuss child welfare, and President Truman personally invited her to attend his inauguration. She was said to be, quote, the foremost leading light in adoption laws, the mother of modern adoption, and a national authority on adoption laws. According to the Tennessee State Library and Archives, Georgia was, quote, a highly respected member of the community and evinced a lavish lifestyle. She had friends among all the prominent families and received support from legislators and local politicians alike. By 1935, Georgia had a waiting list of adoptive parents in North and South America. When Georgia became a well-known name, she suddenly didn't have enough babies to adopt out, so she started finding other ways to procure children. Georgia was able to get many people to help her abduct children because she was close with the former Memphis mayor, E.H. Boss Crump. Crump was known to extort money from all kinds of establishments, and in exchange for their money, they would be immune from prosecution and police harassment. Basically, any city worker was at Crump's bidding. Hospital nurses, doctors, juvenile court employees, police, and more. And Georgia employed people known as spotters all over Memphis to look for poor pregnant women or indigent families, and even children walking alone on the streets. Georgia also had the help of a Shelby County juvenile court judge. Judge Camille Kelly had an informant who worked in welfare. The informant would tell Judge Kelly about babies born into poor families. Judge Kelly would then give an order saying the babies had to be given to the state. And then, of course, the babies went to Georgia so she could sell them. If a parent appealed the court's ruling to take the child away, judges who had been bribed or sometimes blackmailed would rule against the parent. Judge Kelly was responsible for supplying Georgia with around 1,000 of the 5,000 children Georgia would eventually sell. Georgia would take hours-old babies from hospitals and send them to nursing homes around the state. Some of the hours-old babies stolen from hospitals would die due to lack of medical care. Some doctors warned her she shouldn't take children born weighing less than 5 pounds, but she did anyway, and they often died. Georgia would have the doctors complicit with her scheme to get still anesthetized indigent mothers to sign over temporary custody of their child so it could get medical attention. Or sometimes the mother was told their child was stillborn. Doctors would also get poor mothers to give up their child in exchange for their own medical care. Older children were taken from playgrounds, porches, and on the road while walking home. Those children were told that their parents had died or that they could no longer take care of them. Kidnapped children would have their records falsified by judges and city workers. Records were changed to say the child was given up willingly. Birth dates were often changed to make a child seem younger. Birth names and birth parent information could also be changed on a birth certificate. In the Hastings Women's Law Journal, Noel Walensky gave this example. The birth parent information would be changed to say that the mother was a society woman and the father was a prominent physician. Anything to make a child more appealing to a higher class family looking to adopt. Some adoptive parents were given completely fake birth certificates. The main reason for this was so that birth parents could not find their stolen children. There was no record or proof. Georgia would often not have paperwork on a child's heritage, so she would just falsify paperwork. If she did have the paperwork, she would destroy the information and create replacement paperwork. For babies stolen and then taken to the Memphis home, Georgia would often completely ignore what doctors told her to do. She wouldn't give children prescribed formulas or medications. This led to many babies dying. Children mainly suffered from gastrointestinal illnesses. In 1945, dysentery swept through the home, killing almost 50 children. Georgia refused to separate sick babies from healthy babies, often putting 5 to 6 babies in one crib. If one child was sick, soon they all would be. Children at the Memphis branch have said that they suffered physical and sexual abuse by employees. They said as punishment, They were hung from coat racks or dangled down laundry chutes. They were beaten with switches and would only be allowed to eat bread and water for weeks. Author Barbara Raymond interviewed hundreds of survivors who told her the most horrific tales of abuse. One woman, also named Barbara, and her sister Mary were abandoned by their mother and left with Georgia Tan. This survivor named Barbara said that the orphans were often tied with ropes around their wrists and locked in closets, and that this is where Georgia molested her. Mary, her sister, was taken to a bathroom and sexually assaulted with a wooden spoon by Georgia. An anonymous adoptee said that Georgia often called children to her room and told them to sit on her lap. So many of these survivors suffered years of nightmares from the trauma. They all vividly remember Georgia's oddly frilly room. She had come to wearing dresses by this time, trying to be more conforming. But she kept her hair cut very short, wore no makeup and little jewelry, so her frilly room was at first almost comforting to the children taken there. But later, it was what haunted their dreams. It wasn't only the little girls, though that was who Georgia targeted. Little boys were sexually abused by men who worked in the home, and children of both sexes were frequently abused and raped by their adoptive parents in foster homes and boarding homes that Georgia placed them in. She had never bothered to investigate these people or places, but even if she had, I wonder, as a pedophile herself, would she have cared? The girl named Barbara was also sent to an adoptive father who molested her. She ran away and was back in Georgia's care soon. She finally was placed with a good family, but by then, she admitted to author Barbara Raymond she behaved so badly she didn't know why they kept her. She would often beat and torment their natural son. It's a cycle of abuse we are familiar with today. A boy named Billy was sent to several different boarding homes before he was placed with a family. In one, the other children warned him to stay away from the handyman who lived in the basement. But the man got a hold of Billy and forced him into the basement, where he violently raped him. Years later, when he was adopted by a good family, he had to have surgery to repair the trauma he had suffered because he was often incontinent as a result. Billy's is one of the saddest stories in Ms. Raymond's book. He tried to rebuild his life, but his past trauma made it very hard for him to live a normal life. Though he did marry and have children, the marriage ended in divorce and he moved away, not seeing his children much. He traveled often and would later become an outspoken advocate against Georgia in later years. Sadly, he did finally remarry and find happiness, but it was only a couple of years before he died of cancer. Many survivors talked of cigarette burns, scaldings, and being threatened with drowning. They were often held underwater by workers as a means to scare them and keep them under control. So many of these later adults talked of their fear of Georgia's bathtubs. And the babies were the ones who most often made it out of Georgia's care quickly, but often arrived to their adopted parents feverish and dehydrated, sometimes dying within days. Georgia would then bring the parents a new baby. Due to abuse, neglect, and illness, it is believed that around 500 children died while at the Memphis branch under Georgia's care. While Georgia was in charge of the Memphis branch, Shelby County had the highest infant mortality rate in the country. Georgia had children buried in a 14-by-13 trapezoid-shaped area in Elmwood Cemetery. There are 19 graves there. In the 1940s, once every 3 weeks, employees named Alma Walton and Regina Warner would take an early flight to New York or California to adopt babies out. They'd take 4 to 6 babies with them, check into a hotel, often the Biltmore, and meet with the adopting parents. Anne also helped smuggle children out of state. Parents paid around $700. That would be $13,000 today for a child. And that check or money order was made out to Georgia Tan, not the Tennessee Children's Home. Parents were told they were paying for, quote, actual expenses, like transportation, as the home didn't make profits, supposedly. Georgia soon realized she could adopt multiple babies out of state at once, but then would only have to claim that she had taken one child. That way, she could keep the money from the other babies. She would also falsify records to show that the extra babies were adopted to Tennessee families, not out-of-state families. That meant she could pay the in-state adoption fee and pocket the remaining out-of-state fee the family had actually paid her. Georgia always promised adoptive parents that she would find a child that suited their needs. Like if a Jewish family wanted a Jewish child, she promised she would bring them one. But she didn't. She would just lie to the adoptive parents and give the child a Jewish name. Ironically, she spoke out against problems in other orphanages, where children of different faiths were sent to families who wanted a child born in their faith. She particularly criticized a Black woman who ran a home for abusing children in her care. Georgia was also able to change laws due to her connections with legislators. Many legislators were also her customers, so of course they wanted to help. One of the main issues she brought to legislation was that there should be closed adoptions, meaning that biological parents' records would be sealed. Most states ended up signing laws into effect that sealed birth and adoption records. Probably at the peak of Georgia's celebrity, actress Joan Crawford, the infamous Mommy Dearest, adopted twin daughters named Kathy and Cindy from Georgia. They were not the blonde, blue-eyed type that Joan had preferred in her first adopted children, Christina and Christopher. In later life, Kathy and Cindy insisted that Joan had been a good mother, despite Christina's tell-all. But by then, Joan was older and had married the Pepsi executive, and the girls mainly lived at boarding schools, only coming home for the holidays. It's safe to say that Joan had mellowed some by then, or perhaps she had learned from her experience with Christina, that she liked having children around for photo ops, but really preferred them to remain in boarding schools the majority of their lives. Unlike Christina and Christopher, Kathy and Cindy did receive an inheritance when Joan died. Georgia also helped Hollywood power couple June Allison and Dick Powell adopt their daughter Pam. Other famous customers were Lana Turner, Pearl S. Buck, and New York Governor Herbert Lehman. Interestingly, one of her abductees also became famous. Pro wrestler Ric Flair had been kidnapped by Georgia Tan. But as Georgia's fame grew, so did her reputation among legitimate child welfare and adoption agencies. I'm going to pause now to hear a final word from today's sponsors. Finding the perfect present for your mom is tough, especially if you can't spend Mother's Day together. With social distancing, it might be hard for some of us this year. That's why I'm giving someone I love a really meaningful gift this year, StoryWorth. It's an online service that helps your loved ones tell the story of their lives through thought-provoking questions about their memories. This year for Mother's Day, I'm going to give the gift of StoryWorth to my mother-in-law. She doesn't live in the same town as my family, and sometimes we only get to see each other at holidays. I love catching up with her and my other in-laws, laughing and swapping stories. It is really cherished time together. StoryWorth helps capture those memories and preserve them forever. With weekly emailed questions you'd never think to ask, like what have been some of the best surprises in your life? It's the gift of spending time together wherever you live. Reading the weekly stories is fun and makes us all feel closer. I've gotten some hilarious stories about my husband as a child from my mother-in-law, and I can't wait to see what else I will learn about him and his family. After 1 year, StoryWorth will compile all the answered questions and photos you have chosen into a beautiful keepsake book that is shipped for free. I know my family will treasure this book forever. Give your mom the most meaningful gift this year with StoryWorth. Get started right away without the need for shipping by going to StoryWorth.com/Southern Fried. You'll get $10 off your first purchase. That's StoryWorth.com/Southern Fried for $10 off. Sometimes the stress in my life and anxiety get out of hand. Even small tasks seem overwhelming. Is there something bothering you, interfering with your goals? BetterHelp Online Counseling is there for you. They will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. BetterHelp has over 3,000 licensed therapists in all 50 states treating anxiety, stress, depression, trauma, grief, and other issues that so many of us suffer from. From your phone, laptop, or tablet, you can connect with a professional counselor via text, chat, phone, or video, and start communicating with your counselor in under 24 hours. You can send a message to your counselor anytime. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses, and you can schedule weekly sessions with your counselor by video or phone, whichever makes you feel more comfortable. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so it's easy and free to change counselors if you want to, and anything you share is confidential. BetterHelp is more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and there is even financial aid available. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/southern. Join over 800,000 people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp.com/southern. The Child Welfare League of America wrote Georgia multiple times, telling her she needed to stop advertising adoptions. When she didn't stop, the League started looking into her dealings. In 1941, the League stopped endorsing the Memphis branch. They discovered how Georgia would destroy adoption paperwork. When they asked her about destroying the paperwork, Georgia said that she was following state privacy laws because adoption records were secret. The League also stopped endorsing the Memphis branch for many other reasons. They found that Georgia wasn't investigating families before placing a child, and that Georgia wasn't studying a child's heritage before placing them. She was letting parents pick out children, rather than the society placing children in the most suitable home. She was also encouraging fast placements, almost ensuring she was not investigating the adoptive parent's background. She was also engaged in interstate placement of children, which definitely meant she had not inspected the children's home before sending the child there. The League also charged that the staff in Georgia's home did not have necessary professional training or direction, and they were especially incensed by Georgia's newspaper ads. In 1946, the League dropped the Memphis branch and prompted Judge of the Probate Court of Shelby County, Sam O. Bates, to write a 7-page letter to the Commissioner of Public Welfare of the state of Tennessee. Judge Bates listed all of the reasons why the League dropped the Memphis branch as reasons why the branch should be investigated. He asked that there be a complete, thorough, and unbiased investigation into the Memphis branch. Judge Bates said that if the League accusations were true, then he would no longer be able to sanction adoptions from the Memphis branch. Tennessee Governor Jim McCord refused to open an investigation because he was afraid of participating in anything which, quote, might lead to undue publicity with the legislative session. In 1950, new Governor Gordon Browning tasked Memphis attorney Robert Taylor with investigating the Memphis home. One of his goals was to try to get back any money the home had received for placing adoptions. And while he wanted Georgia and her home investigated, he specifically said he did not want anyone indicted. He just wanted her put out of business. The home was shut down in 1950, and a flurry of articles appeared in local papers. On September 13, 1950, it was reported by multiple papers that the Tennessee Children's Home in Memphis was a black market for babies. The papers stated that Georgia had been running the black market for at least 10 years, but more likely 15. It was really almost 25 years. It was estimated that around 1,500 children had been adopted out of the home. Around 80% were adopted to parents in California and New York alone. And it was found that Georgia and her helpers had made around $1 million. That's almost $11 million today. We now know from several studies and books that more than 5,000 children were sold or adopted through the home that Georgia ran. And Georgia was never held accountable for what she did. On September 15, 1950, 59-year-old Georgia died from uterine cancer. This was only days after the home was shut down and she was outed in the newspapers. She had been bedridden for a long time, and her condition worsened in the few days preceding her death. Georgia's funeral was held on September 16th at National Funeral Home in Memphis. Some people who had investigated Georgia and survivors of her home thought she had faked her death after the scandal broke. One person approached someone who attended her open casket wake and funeral and begged to be assured it was Georgia Tan who was buried. The person who attended the funeral swore it was her. At the time of Georgia's death, newspapers still strangely talked highly of her, despite some articles that had exposed her black market crimes. In one article about Georgia's death, the Greenwood Commonwealth said Georgia was, quote, recognized as a national authority on adoption laws and that she had a long and useful career. On her death certificate, Georgia is listed as single. The certificate said she died from general cancer and that she'd suffered from it for 4 years. She only had $80,000 left from her fortune, and she did not leave it to any children's organizations. That's still about $850,000 in 2020 dollars. Anne got about half, and the rest was doled out to some family members. Judge Kelly was also never held accountable for what she did to help Georgia. She had announced her retirement soon after the investigation began, and then she died in 1955. According to a report by the State of Tennessee Department of Public Welfare, Judge Kelly did not profit in any way but, quote, failed on many occasions to aid destitute families and permitted family ties to be destroyed when they might have been preserved. Not one person who worked for Georgia was ever held accountable. No one was ever charged. None of the abusers were even outed until several decades after, when it was way too late. It's sickening to think of the torture those children suffered and never got any justice. In 1951, a bill was introduced into Tennessee legislation to allow a full investigation into the Memphis branch and anyone connected, but the bill died due to former Mayor Crump's ties. A federal investigation was also shut down. Birth parents asking for help to find their children were ignored. The public believed that the adopted children were better off with their adoptive families than with their poor birth families. To make things worse, in 1951, legislation passed the Public Acts of 1951, which made all adoption records, including attempted adoptions, sealed. So parents truly had no way to find their children. When Georgia died, there were still 22 children at the Memphis branch. Only two of those children were reunited with their birth parents. One positive thing that happened because of Georgia is that Tennessee strengthened their adoption laws. Adoption agencies now had to conduct thorough investigations into adopting parents, and provisions were put in place to ensure that birth parents actually wanted to give up their children and weren't coerced. Other states soon followed suit. But her biggest legacy is the legalization of closed or confidential adoptions. She forged birth certificates and erased identities so that birth families could never be reunited. And then she used her political influence to get the legislature to make this the law. In 1994, Tennessee adoptees and advocates began pressuring the legislature to change that law. They wanted their records unsealed. One adoptee, Caprice East, became co-chair of the Tennessee Coalition for Adoption Reform. She personally visited all 133 members of the Senate and House of Representatives, famously following one legislator into the men's room. What the coalition wanted was in two parts: to open the records of all of Georgia Tan's direct victims, the 5,000 children she had stolen and sold who could never find their birth families. This law passed in July of 1995, and at first only opened up the records of Georgia's direct victims. 1 year later, her indirect victims, children born in Tennessee and adopted after Georgia's death, were allowed access to their records. At least 17 states still have laws enforcing sealed adoptions or restricted access to records today. Adoptees in those states cannot access even simple medical history about their parents, much less fill the emotional hole that adoption can leave. Even with the most loving adoptive parents, adoptees feel a part of their life is missing, and they want to find their families. But 70 years after Georgia Tan died, they are still fighting for their basic human right of knowing their own identity. And while we would like to believe that theft of children has stopped, it hasn't. With the legalization of contraceptives, the destigmatization of single mothers, and the legalization of abortion, there were less children available to steal and less vulnerable women and families to steal from in the United States. But it still happens in many parts of the world, including India, Indonesia, Samoa, and of course, Cambodia. There was a really high-profile case of an American woman selling Cambodian children that somehow escaped my attention. Lauren Galindo arranged the adoption of Angelina Jolie's Cambodian son Maddox in 2002. Galindo made almost $10 million before she was investigated. She was sentenced to 18 months in prison, ostensibly for child trafficking, but in reality, she had pled guilty to money laundering and wire fraud. She did admit to falsifying names, dates of birth, places of birth, and family history. She had facilitated over 800 adoptions before she was caught. And she used very similar tactics that Georgia Tan had. She employed spotters in rural and impoverished areas where she would trick destitute mothers into giving up their children. She often promised to have them taken care of and that the mother could get them back when they were ready, but that never happened. Like Georgia, she erased their identities and sold them to adoptive American parents for $10,000 to almost $12,000 in so-called adoption fees. That would be around $14,000 today. Angelina Jolie vehemently denied that her son was stolen. She said that she went to great lengths to ensure that Maddox did not have a living birth mother. Quote, "I would never rob a mother of her child. I can only imagine how dreadful that would feel." She went on to say, quote, "Personally, I prefer to stay on the right side of the law. I would never take a child away from a place where adoption is illegal." This is seen as a swipe at Madonna, who adopted a son from Malawi, where Jolie said, quote, "There's no legal framework for adoption." Talk about deflecting. She privately hired a team of lawyers to make sure that Maddox could not be taken away from her and has faced criticism over the years for not addressing Galindo's crimes. But it didn't get as much press as you would expect. Jolie built a home in Cambodia and lived there with Maddox so he could learn his native culture. She also bought a huge piece of property, turning it into a wildlife preserve, and opened the Maddox Jolie Foundation, later naming it the Maddox Jolie Pitt Foundation after she married Brad Pitt. She is known for her charitable works around the world, but specifically through her foundation in Cambodia, who made her a citizen in 2005 in appreciation of her work. I'm not sure we would ever really know if Maddox was stolen like other children. Perhaps Galindo was much more careful with such a high-profile client. And Angelina Jolie is certainly not a mommy dearest. If anything, she is like Mia Farrow, selfless in her love and care for her children, adopted and natural. I was surprised I had never really heard of the scandal, though it did make headlines at the time. I admit to being a bit of a celebrity news addict, and I just don't remember it. And it rarely makes headlines anymore. The last time it did was in 2017, when a man claimed that he had signed Maddox's birth certificate as father to facilitate the adoption. Jolie was supposed to have had that changed, and the man claimed that that never happened, which meant he could still technically have power of attorney over Maddox Jolie Pitt. As far as I can tell, nothing came of this. The story died, much like the earlier stories about Maddox's adoption. Human trafficking, especially of children for slave labor and prostitution, still goes on all over the world. It's a sickening reality. Every culture and society seem to have evil people who prey on the weak, for profit. In 2015, donations helped create a memorial in Elmwood Cemetery in Memphis, honoring all the unknown children and babies buried there. It reads, "In memory of the 19 children who finally rest here, unmarked if not unknown, and all of the hundreds who died under the cold, hard hand of the Tennessee Children's Home Society. Their final resting place unknown, their final peace a blessing." Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. Thank you to Haley Gray for her research assistance in this case. I definitely recommend reading The Baby Thief, The Untold Story of Georgia Tan, The Baby Seller Who Corrupted Adoption by Barbara Raymond. It is a really insider look at the Georgia Tan story because Ms. Raymond had been through the adoption process herself. She bravely writes about her own fears and how her experience influenced her to investigate Tan and the history of American adoptions. And thank you so much to Mallory Kemp for suggesting this case. As I said in the beginning, I know some states are opening back up, but do what you can to keep yourself safe. If you are still in quarantine, keep the faith. We will get through this. And I will be taking next week off. I'm sorry, I need a breather. And I also need to catch up on some admin work for Southern Fried. My email inbox is crazy, and I owe patrons gifts. I don't like not answering your emails promptly, because I so appreciate receiving them. And patrons, many of you will be hearing from me next week. I know I have several new patrons to thank, and I also owe t-shirts to longtime patrons. I haven't forgotten you guys, I promise. And I really need to get ahead on Southern Fried work, because as some of you already know, I will be hosting a new podcast called Fetal Abduction, a true crime podcast. I'm really excited to be working with Haley Gray's team. By the end of May, you'll have two places to listen to me. I'm going to drop a trailer for the new show in my feed next Friday for a preview, so I hope you will subscribe. And I'd like to remind you to come join my Facebook group. There may not be a new episode next week, but I'll be around, laughing at your memes, sharing some myself, and just staying connected. It's a lovely community, and we would love to have you. And I'll be recommending some of my favorite podcasts in the group next week, so you should come check it out. And please, if you are suffering abuse in quarantine or having suicidal thoughts, please look at today's show notes for resources. You are not alone. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher and Spotify, as well as Stitcher Premium, where you can listen ad-free. If you have any case suggestions, please email southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I'm sorry, but I no longer answer private messages on social media. I manage three platforms, and it's just too overwhelming. But please feel free to reach out by email. Not only do I get my most interesting and little-known cases from listener suggestions, I love hearing from you guys. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Wash your hands, stop touching your face, and y'all take care.